So I'm happy to have the introduction to the talk. Those of you who read the announcement will know why the H is in purple in my name here. The work I'm describing is based on, well, part of it is based on a thesis that was done a long time ago by my student Ernest Chan. So this is a so part of this is just half of this, at least, is just a reminder of things that some of you may have heard in talks before, but then again, maybe not many of you. So this is also a not about exotic systems, but about things that will have a regular long-range order, mainly, and the search for that. There also was a talk at the last March meeting about the current work on the pyrochloric lattice by my student Uzi Hisi. I have not published anything about the work on the pyrochlor lattice, but Oleg Chernyshov has published several summaries of what I've done. So I'm going to work on that. I'm going to work on that next month. That was what I was supposed to work on at ITP. So here's this. Because I have heard a little too many Blackboard talks here. I will have a pure transparency talk, and I will talk about the results first so that I will be sure to actually get to them. The key notion is the following. I have an approach to find the true ground state for we have a frustrated system where it is not obvious what the true ground state will be. To the lowest orders, there's some degeneracy which we have to find a way to resolve. A spin wave zero-point energy breaks the degeneracies. This is pretty well known. That breaks it only part way. That gives us a discrete family of subsets of the states of the classical ground states of these magnets. We then find a way of representing the Hamiltonian such that the discrete parameters that describe the possible discrete states we have appear as the coefficient in some kind of approximate Hamiltonian. And then treating that in some perturbative way, some kind of crude and approximate way, we will then obtain an effective Hamiltonian in terms of these discrete spins. And therefore, you will get an effective Hamiltonian that's defined on any one of the possible discrete states that you feed into it, not just the ones that are nice or periodic or especially simple. The outline of the talk, the order of the talk, is that it will come in three roughly equal parts. The first part will be a review and preview of the general ideas and where I'm coming from. Then there will be one part about the Kagame lattice and then a second part about the pyrochlor. So there is a warning that there is essentially two talks in here, but I've given this many times before, and it doesn't usually take more than much. It takes only a little bit more than an hour. This is the wrong portion. Let me talk about the general idea. I wanted to talk about the general notion. Again, I apologize that I was invited just a week ago to do this, and the transparencies, so I didn't know to bring transparencies, and I was not able to get the true transparencies, so they all had to be copied over. And one really thinks that an institute which has such marvelous architecture wouldn't have such cheap transparency marking pens. But anyway, this is what we have. So the idea of frustration, you all are very familiar with frustration, so I can go through this quickly. It's not, the old-fashioned notion isn't right that we have some terms in the Hamiltonian which we could satisfy any one at a time, but not satisfy them all at the same time. What really matters is that we have a very large degeneracy or near degeneracy of states, and as a consequence, by small additional terms, we can mix these states together in various ways and create a collective state which has got different kinds of order or lack of order or whatever, which of course the exotic people know very well and have been using recently. So one expects to have a rich phase diagram in such a system, that tweaking these perturbations a little way this way or that way will lead to different ways of resolving this degeneracy. And that, I think, the chief reason why frustrated anti-ferromagnets ought to be of general interest, and the same reason that, of course, metals are the other fertile ground for finding states with various kinds of order that are in solid-state physics. And it's for the similar reason that you have this very large density of low-energy excitations. Now, here are the two example systems, just to get you warmed up. The Kagame lattice is the one shown here. I think everyone knows that. I'm interested in the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model. So just nearest neighbor interactions, anti-ferromagnet. And the important thing is that for this talk, these are large S spins. These are a semi-classical limit, which is, of course, not at all the same thing as the classical limit. It's easier to deal with a purely classical model where you just say, I have these unit vectors interacting, and I do the thermal ensemble. And that's better understood, better controlled in general. But the intuition that it gives you is not necessarily the right intuition. Some of the important work that Roderick Mersner did was on showing that the pyrochlore lattice with classical spins is in some well-defined sense less ordered than the Kagame lattice. And whereas with the quantum spins, I would say that the Heisenberg lattice is more ordered in some sense than the Kagame lattice. The pyrochlore is more ordered, yeah. Thank you. So definitely what I'm doing is not going to work for spin a half. And so the question I want to solve is exactly, I expect that for large S, that the right answer is going to be some kind of Naill order. And the question, though, is which kind? And I would like to say that I think that all the people who have said, who have intuitions which are other than that, their intuitions are either based on mindless extensions of the classical classical result, or else on large S results. So this is a pyrochlore lattice. And I just would like to point out that the pyrochlore lattice, both the pyrochlore and the Kagame lattice, are medial lattices. That is, by medial lattice, I mean that you take some other lattice, in this case, the diamond lattice in which has got a cubic symmetry, and you place spins on the midpoints of this. And so the bonds which are interacting are connecting any two spins from a bond which shares a common endpoint, and that makes these tetrahedra. And that will be important for the properties of this, and in general, there's a whole class of lattices which are like that, and the kind of things I'm talking about will tend to be true for that. This is another picture of a pyrochlore lattice. I don't know if that works any better.
You say the pyrochlore is the lattice of bonds?
The pyrochlore lattice is, well, I don't know what the word when we say lattice in solid state physics, it's an abuse of notation when it's not a Bréve lattice, I guess. But so to me, a lattice is a set of vertices and the bonds connecting them. And in this case, each site has got a six-fold coordination, and it consists of tetrahedra, which are sharing their corners. Half of the tetrahedra are pointing upwards, half of them pointing downwards. Does that answer?
No, so I'm just trying to understand, where does the
corners are the, pardon?
Where's the diamond lattice here?
The centers of the, that's exactly the point. The centers of the tetrahedra are the diamond vertices, yeah.
Wonderful.
Okay, if that satisfies you, that's
enough.
Yeah, the Kagame lattice is similarly constructed from the honeycomb lattice by putting bonds on the midpoints. And the honeycomb lattice, as we all know, is the best you can do, is the best you can do for a diamond lattice in two dimensions. So now, what do we know about this from the past? So I won't say it in gory detail, but basically, on either of these lattices, any classical configuration of directions such that the three or four vectors add up to zero is a ground state, and there are many ways of doing that. I skipped too quickly over this frustration slide, but when we say highly frustrated, I think a highly frustrated anti-ferromagnet can be stated precisely what you mean is that if you have this continuous set of classical ground states, the number of degrees of freedom, the number of real parameters that specify the manifold of states is proportional to the system size. Whereas for most kinds of things, like for example, for a face-stated cubic antiferromagnet, ordinary FCC antiferromagnet, there will be one or two or five real numbers that will specify a classical degeneracy. But there will be only five in the whole system. It's not proportional to the system size. So these highly frustrated ones are different that way. If you talk about discrete models, like an Ising model on an FCC lattice, Well, again, a high frustration means that the number of ground states is exponential in the system size. Obviously, if it was continuous, you couldn't count them in a counting sense. Now, how have we dealt with these things? So, in the past, I dealt with these things in the context of something like the FCC anti-fraud magnet, where there was a finite number of degeneracy parameters. So let's review. So where I'm coming from is how we dealt with things in that way, and then we'll see how that the ways in which that doesn't work on the highly frustrated systems and what we do about it. So this was a concept of order due to disorder. This name was taken somewhat illegitimately from something that Villain did in reference to discrete magnets. So imagine you have this is, I didn't actually show the bond, I forgot to show the bonds here. This is actually the J1, J2. Can you all visualize a second neighbor bond, or should I draw one in? So this is the J1, J2 anti-Friedel magnet in the regime where J2 is big enough that the ground states are such that the second neighbors ought to be opposite. And so they form an anti-ferromagnetic lattice. And so you can rotate, so there's a non-trivial freedom that you can rotate the second sub, the even sites with respect to the odd sites by any angle psi. Now this is not a symmetry at all. They have exactly the same classical energy, but if we were to expand the harmonic spin waves around these states, we would get different results. We would get different spectra, omega of k. And so if we add together the omega of k to compute the zero-point energy, then the way I want to think of that is to say that we're eliminating all the degrees of freedom we're throwing out all the states except for the classical ground states. The classical ground states are parameterized by this one angle psi. So I now have this one coordinate describing the whole system. And I can think of this as an effective Hamiltonian in terms of that one coordinate psi. And what it looks like is this, and the minimum occurs for the states which are collinear, where the spins are pointing up or down along the same axis. And it's maximized for the states where they're perpendicular. And that will be something that we will come back, that we'll use that later on. As a side remark, which is not really, I'm not really using here, is that if we took a classical model, the effect of finite temperature is similar to that. But as I say, it may not be as, we expect in general the quantum models to be more ordered than the classical models in the same dimension. And that I think is true for the Kagame and the pyrochlore. This classical problem is the one that Mersenne dealt with in his thesis. The other thing something that we ought to think of a lot more is the role of dilution. The role of dilution in these simply frustrated systems is to select a state usually the opposite kind than the kind that thermal or quantum fluctuations select. In the highly frustrated systems, as I expressed in a talk at a conference 4 years ago, the highly frustrated magnetism, the effect is quite different.
Why does dilution favor in the opposite order? Is that something we can see intuitively?
It is, but it's nothing to do with this talk, so I'll tell you afterwards. That was the talk I was giving 15 years ago. I probably even gave it at UCLA once.
My memory is a little fuzzy.
It was 15 years ago. I don't even feel embarrassed.
That was probably my job talk at UCLA when I was interviewing for assistant professor. Okay.
I wasn't yet at UCLA.
True. That's right. I heard your job talk when you interviewed at Boston University for
professor.
Okay, well, things go around in circles. So here's the spin wave expansion which this is being based on. So I'm and the point is, of course, that we take the Holstein-Primakov expansion, we can write everything in terms of bosons, and there's a harmonic term which is quadratic, which is very easy to deal with. And then there are terms of higher order which are going to be important as well. Okay, so what's the philosophy? So far, I've only talked about the harmonic terms. I've only used them. So now the philosophy of the approach, then, that I've already given a simple example of, the usual way that people approach this kind of question is they construct two or three candidate states, which are typically highly symmetric, they have small unit cells, and they are tractable. And then they try to evaluate the effective energy for each of those states as best as they can, and then compare which wins. Now, the approach that I'm using is to construct an effective Hamiltonian which will work on any one of those states. It's usually a subspace of the whole set of classical ground states, which is defined by some previous level of selection. So there's there may be a hierarchy of different kinds of terms, usually going with different energy scales, each of which breaks down the symmetry, that breaks down the degeneracy, which is not a symmetry, to a smaller subset. Now, the disadvantages first of my approach is that the quota of the Hamiltonian you get is crude in general. You'll have, you can only put in terms which you like, nearest neighbor. The real effective Hamiltonian, which always must exist in principle, there's some, there's some function of each of those states, that will have terms of infinitely long range interaction and things and involving large numbers of spins, which you don't want to think about. But it's obviously going to be inaccurate for this reason, that you're leaving out all those messy terms. And secondly, the derivation of this usually involves uncontrolled assumptions, that there's no good small parameter in the ways that I'm describing today. Now, the preview of the main results which I'm going to be getting are the... I didn't say the advantages, did I? I'm not positive-minded enough. The advantages are that maybe the right state that you want, maybe the right answer is not one of the two states that you thought of to check. Now, in the first story of the Kagame story, it turns out the state that we get is a state that everybody already thought about, the root 3 by root 3 state. In the case of the Pyroclore, the state that we get is in fact a state which is different from the states that everyone thought of. The other advantages are that you could use this effective Hamiltonian to build some other theory on. You could do a thermal ensemble, for example, and study thermal properties based on using this toy Hamiltonian. And for people in this room, you might be interested in making a quantum discrete model out of this by putting on some kind of tunneling term that will flip between one state and another. These are like quantum dimer models and that sort of thing. Now. And so they might have, you might be able, in other words, to get a state where within some continuous spin that has a continuous degree of freedom, you may have the situation that for some range of temperatures or energy scales, you will reduce that to some discrete subset. And within the discrete subset, you may be able to build up a state which would have exotic properties. And it would also have this overall like spin-pneumatic kind of degree of freedom. I'm not going to talk much about that, but you can just, maybe that will be a motivation so that you won't all get bored and leave. Preview of my main results now, so that after this, I suppose you can get bored and leave. The Kagame system, we can label the states which are selected by the harmonic fluctuations by a discrete variable which has values plus or minus one living on the triangles called the chiralities. This is an old notion. It turns out that the effective Hamiltonian, it turns out, is got exactly the same energy to harmonic order for all of these states. So there's no harmonic selection. That's very weird. And the anharmonic term we find can be written in terms of a bilinear in these chiralities, and such that it turns out that it wants to have an anti-Fermat arrangement of these etas. Remember, these plus or minus things live on the triangle centers, which are the vertices of a honeycomb lattice, so it's bipartite. And that is the same thing as the root 3 by 3 order. I'll show all the details of that. Well, I'll show the outline of that in what these things are defined as. In the case of the Pyroclore, the Ising variables, which I call by the same name eta sub I, are really the actual spin, but they're all aligned up or down along some axis so that you can label them by Ising spins. And to harmonic order, the effective Hamiltonian has a very neat form. It's the product of the Ising, the terms in it are the products around loops of the Ising spins. So it has the mathematical appearance of a Z2 gauge theory. It has all the gauge, now it's not literally a gauge theory, I would say, because these states are truly different states. They're not gauge, they're a gauge theory. The different ways of labeling it are just the same state, but here they are truly different states. But you have a degeneracy which is just like a gauge degeneracy. And the state which is selected is the one where the product is minus around these, and that turns out to be it turns out that all the simple states that the product is plus around these. So it selects a fairly complicated large unit cell. And it has the weird property that although there's a very large an exponential degeneracy of these, but the entropy of such possible states is not extensive, it seems. So it's got a sort of intermediate, and so we still have to work further to find out what the answer is by going to the harmonic terms, and that's what my grad student is doing now. Okay, let's get started on the Kagame. Any questions so far? That was the end of the first part of my talk.
So the degeneracy is exponential in the linear dimension of the system?
That's right. He was referring to the case that just flashed by about the pyrochlore lattice, the states which are selected by the harmonic order flux zero point energy is the exponential of L, where L is the linear size of the system, and the number of sites is L cubed.
Fix the spins on the boundary.
Right, you fix it. Yeah. So you. No, sorry. It's less than that. The boundary would be L squared. So in other words, you can stack layers, and each time you stack a layer, you have one choice. That's how you can show that it's got to be that degeneracy. There's a small chance that it could be even.
You have this sort of this little product, which is the
Hamiltonian
harmonic order. I mean, presumably, there's also a longer loop.
There's longer loops,
yeah. Wouldn't that be the more natural thing to include next rather than going to anharmonic term? Because, I mean, your expansions don't actually control the length of the loop.
Well, I don't know what you mean by next. I mean, I've already gone to the next term in the loops. No, Roderick, I mean, these states, the states are exact, the degeneracy is exact between these states to all orders in loops. I don't need to go to higher orders in loops. The gauge-like symmetry is exact, so I have to go to anharmonic to break that. I mean, what I would, you know, to go to the higher orders in the loops, I would do that in order to, I could do that because sometimes that I might, it might be that the, that, that I don't know which, you know, I have this state and all the ones which are gauge equivalent to it. Then I have some higher energy states which are collinear states, so that this Hamiltonian applies to them, but they are higher in energy, and then they're all gauge equivalent to each other. And to know how big the energy differences are between those states, or even to know that possibly that this wasn't the right one, but another one was the right one, I would have to look at those higher loops. But to break the degeneracy between them, I have to go to anharmonic. Okay, but that's obviously why that's so, of course, won't be clear till I've gone through it. Let's talk about the Kagame case now in detail. So to get a handle on these states, what we first, let's imagine that we look at the special case where the spins all lie in the plane of the screen. And so the ground state of one triangle are defined by the sum of spins is equal to zero. And that's simply because, for those of you who haven't seen this before, the Hamiltonian can be written as a sum of squares of terms, each of term of which is the sum of spins on one triangle or one tetrahedron. That's what's special about these medial lattices, really. They would all have this property. So basically, then, that means that on a triangle, that the spins are 120 degrees apart. There's only one way of doing it on within that triangle. But if we put it in the plane, we notice that once we specify the direction of one spin, all the other spins everywhere in the whole world are related to that by multiples of 120 degrees, because on one triangle, they have to be. In any triangle, there's really just two choices. Having chosen the direction of the top spin, the others are either spin type. We can call them, in other words, by discrete labels A, B, and C for the three different directions. And so it becomes a discrete three-state Potts model. And any triangle, it's just A, B, C or A, C, B around it. Now, shown below there are two very special periodic states. The one on the left is called the root 3 by root 3 state because the magnetic unit cell is root 3 times bigger than the actual lattice unit cell. And this is called Q equals 0 because the magnetic cell is the same as the lattice cell. And they're both very, very simple and periodic, but they're different states. In this case, that if you go around one of these rings, it goes A, B, A, B, A, B, for example. And around, in this case, if you go along one of these lines, it goes A, B, A, B, A, B. There's some weird sense which I cannot quite figure out, in which this is what you get by sort of taking this ring and rolling it along one of these lines. But I don't want to. I haven't thought that was just something that occurred to me late last night. So let's not talk more about that. There are a lot of other states which can be derived, for example, by taking. If you take the ring of six here, you can actually rotate this out of the plane without. And still be a ground state if you rotate around the axis pointing that way. I am not going to spend a lot of time on that, but that's where this very large number of degrees of freedom comes from for the states which are not necessarily coplanar. The states which I'm describing here, there's also, though, many ways of writing down these discrete labels to make a, not just these regular ways, but there's just many other ways that satisfy that every triangle has got one of each of the three colors in it. And And that has an exponential degeneracy of these discrete states, which are called coplanar states. So I'm going to focus on the coplanar states. Now, there is a nice way of labeling the coplanar states, which helps us understand them a little bit better, which are called chiralities. So around every triangle, basically, the spins, if we walk around the triangle, the spins are either rotating toward the left or rotating toward the right by 120 degrees as we take steps around the triangle. So we put a plus or minus depending on which. We could parameterize that as well by just saying that Si cross Sj is either proportional to the plus z direction or the minus z direction, where z is the direction perpendicular to the plane these spins adopt. Remember, of course, the plane the spins adopt has got no particular connection to the plane that the in real space that these spins are in, because I didn't put any spin lattice coupling in this model. It's just an arbitrary plane in spin space that they've all chosen to be within that same plane by some symmetry breaking. Now, if we go look at what that means in terms of the two nice lattices I talked about, the root 3 by root 3 lattice is the lattice where these are alternating, these chiralities, and the q equals 0 state is where they're all the same, either all plus or all minus. And then there are many other states where they look sort of random. A comment about this, I've mapped this into something that looks like Ising variables. Now, the mapping is from it. Given a configuration of the pluses and minuses, I can definitely reconstruct all the other spins. I can reconstruct the coplanar state. But it's not true that you can, that I can, however, if you give me a random collection of pluses and minuses, it might not correspond to any valid state. So this is only a subset of all the different arrangements of pluses and minuses which are actually allowed in my ensemble. Now, I'm going to put this to work in a moment, this idea of chiralities. So let's try to do this old approach, this harmonic selection. We're just computing the effective energy from adding up the zero-point energy to harmonic order. And remember, this is like a term in a 1 over S expansion of the energy. I didn't emphasize it as I should have, but the spin wave expansion is an expansion in powers of 1 over S, and 1 over S is my small parameter. The classical energy is of order S squared. The spin waves are of order S. The answer is, well, as a function of the angle, if I rotate the spins out of the plane that the other spins are in, the energy goes up linearly with that rotation, which was something that Ritchie, Chandra, and Coleman originally published. And so definitely there's a selection of the coplanar states. The coplanar states are local minima of this harmonic energy, and whatever the true answer is, it's going to be one of the coplanar states. You look puzzled, Steve.
Yeah, why is it non-analytic?
Why is it non-analytic? There's a quick answer to that, but I don't remember it. Why are anti-ferromagnetic spin waves dispersion non-analytic? Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the same answer, but I'm forgetting the details.
It's the second order of time derivative by the time you integrate out some of your
model. It's coming from the fact that the energy cost, that if I actually ask the energy cost of rotating these guys out, right, to harmonic order, there's no cost at all to rotating out of the planar. So it's like you've got an energy which is quartic. Maybe it's just you're taking the square root of something which is quartic and, no, okay, forget it. I cannot reproduce that right now. I haven't been thinking about this for, 8 years in detail.
Hey, you want me to remember something 15 years ago?
This is a detail. All I want you to remember is whether you've heard the talk before. So anyway, the weird thing that happened, though, is that the whole notion breaks down because the harmonic order, every single one of these states, all the completely random-looking ones, have exactly the same spin wave dispersion. And therefore, the effective Hamiltonian that I would construct is the same for all of them. And I have to go to anharmonic order to get anything which will distinguish between these states. Now,
so the way you derive this is, so this is just adding the zero-point energy.
Yeah.
We just tell you which Hamiltonian state is better.
Yeah.
How you determine the dispersion for that? You need to...
I have the classical spin directions, and then I just do the Holstein-Primakoff expansion, and I take the quadratic parts.
Okay.
So at the moment, I have not used the anharmonic parts at all. It's just traditional spin wave theory. But this is correct to lowest order in 1 over s. So now, let's zero in on this is what the spin wave expansionally actually looks like in the Kagame case. Okay, so it's not really that many terms, but anyway, H2 is up here, and the thing which I would point out that I'm sorry for the not having a nice figure about this, but you write it and that is an error down there, and I had better correct that before these things are all digitized and sent out to webland. It's very useful to we actually write these variables in terms relative to the direction that the spins actually are, so that the z direction is out of the plane, and then there's and then the other parameters actually, which is called sigma sub ix and the parameterization that Schender and company actually introduced, is really an angle of rotation within the plane. And by writing in this relative fashion, the actual functional form of this really does look independent of the choice of these directions. And by the way, this is just a word to the wise to the people who sit down and say that that they read the prescription and they say, well, this thing has a 9-spin unit cell, and therefore we've got to write a 9 by 9 matrix of bosons in order to diagonalize this, which is how you will find it done, for example, in a Zhang and Elser's paper about this. That's totally unnecessary. If you take this viewpoint, the effective unit cell is actually just 3 spins, and you can get a much simpler matrix that you have to diagonalize by taking advantage of this effective symmetry. Anyhow, the important things about this expansion that I will point out is that the coefficient here is -1/2, simply because that's the direction that's the angle between the classical directions, and furthermore, that the only way it does depend, but only one way, on the which of the configurations we're expanding around, namely, in the odd order terms, the coefficient here, this is actually depending on the directions of the spins, and it turns out this is nothing more than the chirality. So in other words, this coefficient is the same value, √3/2, but in some triangles it's plus, on some triangles it's minus, depending on whether the spins go ABC or ACB around that triangle. And all the other garbage, algebraic garbage here, is exactly the same in all of these states. Okay. The quartic term, by the way, also was like the quadratic term, didn't care about these directions. So what can we do? Well, here was the bright idea, which sort of works and has a problem, though. We'll see. We have this H3 order Hamiltonian, which is expressed as a sum of terms, H alpha. Alpha is just labeling which triangle it's on, and each has a coefficient eta alpha, which is +/-1. So let's do second order perturbation theory in this. We assume that we have already constructed the ground state for the harmonic, for the harmonic term. We've got its energies at E sub n. And so we just write the usual second-order perturbation, and that will be our effective Hamiltonian. And it depends implicitly on these etas. And if we expand out the square here, of course, it's going to be each of these terms. We can insert a state. Well, we have this set of excited states, n. So each of these terms here was linear in the eta. So we can bring out the etas and collect everything else and just call it an effective indirection J. I'm saying the bottom line is that since our Hamiltonian was linear in these parameters eta that specify the state, this perturbation term will be bilinear in that. And we can interpret it as an effective Ising-like Hamiltonian. So all we have to do is figure out what J alpha beta is. Hopefully this thing will be important only for the first and second neighbors, let's say. And so if it's positive, that would lead to a ferromagnetic arrangement, which is the Q equals zero state. If it's the other way, it would lead to the other arrangement. And if J1 and J2 are both comparable, we might actually get some different arrangement, which is what my student and I thought for about 2 weeks when we had made an error. So it's not preordained that it's one of those two answers is the right answer, as far as I can see. Now, there's a big, big problem with this approach. Namely, one of the three branches of spin wave excitations is flat zero across the band, as is well known. And the interpretation for that is that you have local modes of small deviations which alternate plus and minus around a hexagon. It's just on those six spins only. And if I think about the energy, which said that I had the sum of squares of the terms on the triangles, every triangle that is involved with this has got one plus and one minus. So the lowest order, the triangles, the spin did not change on any of the triangles, and therefore the energy doesn't change to lowest order. So to quadratic order, it doesn't cost you anything to do this. That's where you get all these, and since they're local in the hexagons, that's why it's sort of, you can make linear combinations of them with any wave vector. Anyway, why this is bad is there's two reasons actually why it's bad in the perturbation theory. Number one, the energy denominators are zero. And number two, the numerators, the matrix elements, may be infinite because this state has got, because these modes, of course, have infinitely large zero-point fluctuations. Clearly something has to be done. What can be done? Well, this is, again, pretty crude and straightforward. You can do some kind of self-consistent theory, and it was done. Chubukov had a paper about it where he showed how you would do that. His main focus in that paper was to show that the coplanar states are locally stable against the anharmonic terms. But you could do the same. We actually, in Chan's thesis, did it in a Brock way, which is not the right way, by a variational approach, which in the end I think is basically equivalent to what Chubukov did, but a lot harder. Anyway, the bottom line though is that in this, to do this part, you need the quartic terms as well as the cubic terms. You need the quartic terms to first lowest order, the cubic terms to second order, and at the end of the day, the effective energy scale is of order s to the 2/3, which is smaller than s, smaller than what it would have been for just the ordinary harmonic spin waves. And at the end of the day, we also found that we could approximate the important terms in this sum by saying that the excitation energy was actually independent of the momentum, and therefore we could factor it out of the sum here, and then collapse the complete set of states in the sum to get that the effective coupling J alpha beta was proportional to some expectation of the Hamiltonian. Remember, within the zero state. The zero state is not literally the spin wave state anymore, but it's a variational state, which is similar to the spin wave state, where we've gotten rid of these zero energy modes and the infinite fluctuations. And so you could read off, and you can read off from that this has got a negative correlation, and then you're done. It's the anti-Fromm-Mangat answer, which is the one everyone thought about. And that's the end of the Kagame story. So are there questions about that now? I've just given you an outline. I've swept the nasty part under the rug, which is this self-consistent theory.
Is that the right, does this self-consistent theory, because that s to the 2/3 a correct answer? I mean, is the energy that selects it?
But what do you mean by correct? How would I, what better way would I know if it was correct?
I don't know. I mean, is that supposed to be, do you think that that's a,
there's yes,
presumably some exact answer, whether we know it or not.
I believe that this is the exact and correct scaling. Yes. What's actually odd is that it turns out that for reasons that I don't think I can explain in sufficient detail, and I always thought that the Pyroclore case would be similar. That, I mean, in the case of the Pyroclore less, we have the H for the anharmonic parts, which is what my student is working on right now. You have the H4, it turns out, but you don't have to worry about the H3, which makes it a lot simpler to deal with. And I always thought that since these were scaling the same way in the Kagame case, that you would get this, that getting rid of this wouldn't make a big difference. You'd still get the S to the 2/3 behavior. Turns out that's totally wrong. That the Pyroclore case, it looks like you get logarithmic. So the corrections are like S over log S or something. Anyway, so. Yeah.
There is some configuration of chirality.
Yes. It's the one that I said the √3/√3 state, and I'll show that to you again. That was the one that I showed at the beginning. Actually, the one that I showed on the first transparency happened to be an example of the √3/√3 state. Does that? What do you mean there is no problem?
Why we need this extra? I think so.
If I do spin waves on this, I get a branch of excitations which has got omega equal to zero. And if I were to calculate with ordinary, yeah?
No, I don't mean the second order, no? I don't know if it's going to be there, it's being there.
No, but it doesn't, then there are lots of other states that would be degenerate with.
Ah. Yeah, that was what I was saying, that all the coplanar states.
The other anharmonic pair.
No, you're right that if I only want the energies, I could forget about the fact that these states have got infinite zero-point fluctuations if I only wanted the energies from it. But the thing is that they all have the same energies. And so then I have to do this other stuff. And when I'm putting these matrix elements, then I do have to worry about the fact that they have infinite.
And does that mean that if I tried to calculate the dispersion of that lowest line spin wave mode, that it would have an energy that goes like S to the...
That's right. It's now been given most of these K vectors, it now has a gap and it's of order S to the 2/3. Yeah.
Whereas the others are
over S. Yeah. Of course, as you can see, this thing actually has a Goldstone point. So which is a complication to me, because I had this sort of invariance that I was treating all of these different states as being equivalent to this zero order. And in fact that's not going to be quite accurate because that would sort of require me to imagine that omega 3 is totally flat, and it isn't really. But I'm not sure that I really. Anyway, that's a technical detail again, which I did not have time to refresh myself about because I was finishing a paper on a different subject. So okay, was there any other question, or should I move on? You had a question actually. Did I answer your question as well as answering his? Okay.
It was the same question. I would hope so.
Where S is equal to a half. Okay. Well, what is it? The student is not greater than his master?
Sorry.
You pick how many people you want to insult in one sentence.
I'm sorry, that's from the Bible. Okay.
I know where it goes.
Okay, let's go to the pyrochlore large S antiferromagnet now, the final portion of this talk. This is a summary which Uzi Heezy put in his talk. It's basically that, I'm saying it's a similar story, but with some important differences. And I organized this table to show more clearly what the differences are. Okay, the Kagame, the discrete set of states which we would select would be coplanar. In the case of the pyrochlore, it's collinear. Each tetrahedron, in the case of the pyrochlore, we have four spins on the tetrahedron, and in the Kagame, they wanted to be collinear, I would say, because I would say that the quantum fluctuations with exchanging directions always wants to be collinear. But of course, they are forced to be adding up to zero, and there's no way for a triangle to add up to zero. They have to be 120 degree state. In the case of a tetrahedron, however, they can add up to zero and be collinear, so two of them are up and two of them are down along some arbitrarily chosen axis. And it can be verified that is a local minimum of the harmonic energy, just as the coplanar was that I showed in the case of the Kagame. Secondly, H2, harmonic term in the case of the Kagame, as I showed, it didn't break the degeneracy at all among these states. In the case of the pyrochlore, that will be the main subject of my talk, because it does partially break it. And so now, in the case of the pyrochlore, I'm going after an effective Hamiltonian that describes what H2 does. And this is, I guess these are some technical parts which are more concerned with what goes on the anharmonic stuff. So let's go in order and through the pyrochlore things. Okay, so what I want to do again is I want to get the harmonic zero point, so I want to calculate the harmonic zero point energy. Now, it's going to look slightly different now, because in this case, the convenient way to think about it is from the viewpoint of classical dynamics. Now, I hope that most of you know or will trust that if I take one of these spin wave, these spin wave systems have a semi-classical dynamics, and it's usually the way I would prefer to understand the spin wave motions of some antiferromagnet. Namely, each spin has got a local field, which is like the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to that spin. So it's just like a force acting on it. And it has an equation of motion which says it precesses around that field, which is like the Newton's equations for the spin. And so this is the semi-classical equation of motion. If we then find the frequencies of this motion, then to the lowest harmonic order, these are the same as the frequencies you would get out from the Holstein-Primakoff expansion. So basically, let's see what happens. So we have I got into trouble because this is a transparency which I was going to write another one about, and then I changed my mind. But I have the transparency which goes here. It's on the next sheet, and I don't remember. I haven't gotten there yet. This sheet just has the things which I already told you are just repeated. It's slightly redundant because this is from a separate talk. So let's go on to the actual dynamics which I will insert to get out, which I will linearize. This is the dynamics that says Si dot is equal to Si cross Hi. And there's probably a 1 over S factor missing where S is the length of the spin. Hi was this local field. It precesses around. And now, here is a very cute thing that one can do that's specific to this kind of medial lattice. And this was originally worked out by Mersner and Chalker. They were doing it to understand the classical dynamics. If you have this sort of collective paramagnet and the system is sort of doing a random walk through this large manifold of classical ground states, and they were trying to understand better what the dynamic exponent of that would be. I'm using it here for a different purpose, but the idea is the following. Let's think about the variable which is called L alpha, which is the sum of the spins in a tetrahedron labeled by alpha. This is tetrahedron alpha 1, tetrahedron alpha 2. And consider spin I, which is shared between them. Well, the local field on that is simply the sum of for the exchange interaction, Si dot Sj. It's just taking the derivative with respect to Si. So it's simply the sum over of all the nearest neighbor spins. There are three nearest neighbors in this tetrahedron. The sum of their spins is the total spin minus yourself. Right? You know, L alpha 1 is the sum of all the four spins. And if I subtract out Si, I get the sum of the three which are neighbors to I. And if I do the same thing on the other tetrahedron, I get the total local field acting on it, which is just the sum of the two L alphas minus twice Si itself. When I stick that into this formula, Si cross Hi, lo and behold, the part which I subtracted off for itself is going to vanish because I'm taking Si cross Si. So what's left so far is that I have Si dot is proportional to Si cross the sum over the two neighboring tetrahedra of the tetrahedron spins. Now what I can do next is I can ask, what about the tetrahedron spin, the equation of motion for the tetrahedron spin? If I do the same thing for every one of these spins in this tetrahedron, I'm going to get each one of them will have Si cross two terms. One of them will be this tetrahedron itself, and the other will be one of the four neighboring tetrahedra which are connected to it. So that's what I have here. Now, if I collect these terms together, the first of these terms, Si cross L alpha, where this is repeating four times, the sum of the Si's is just L alpha itself. So this cross product, again, will vanish. And what's left finally at the end of the day is that the delta L alpha dot is simply the sum. So this is a tetrahedron. It's linked by four spins to four other tetrahedra. And it's simply Si, the spin on the link, cross the other tetrahedron. When I linearize this, the tetrahedron spin is zero to linear order. So I didn't get any, you would think I have Si cross L alpha. That's the term I have here. When I linearize it, I'll have a term which is delta Si cross L alpha zero order. But L alpha zero, L beta, zero order, is simply zero. In the ground state, all these tetrahedron spins added up to zero. That was the definition of a ground state. So that term is not there. What I get finally is I get an autonomous equation for the tetrahedron spins, for the deviations that they have from zero, where the coefficients in that are the zero are the ground state values of the spins in between. So far, by the way, this would be good even for a non-collinear state. But this is a key thing, and I want to pause here for a moment to see if you trust what I have done here. I've derived an autonomous equation for the tetrahedron spins, where the only thing that distinguishes one expanding around one state and a different state is occurring in the coefficients that are sticking in here in this equation of motion. You're all happy? You're all resigned? The other comment that I would make is that...
So this gives a fraction of the modes.
That's right. I mean, you can see that, you know, if the L alphas have got some frequency, some eigenfrequency, that must be one of the eigenfrequencies of the original spins themselves. Now, it turns out, which is not obvious, that all the other ones that I lost are zero. So if I add up the omegas that come from this way, I get the right answer, because all the other frequencies were zero modes, all the ones that I lost.
So in other words, it's just position of motion of the total angular momentum of each tetrahedron.
Yeah, so in other words, the tetrahedra have all the information that I need to know. Now, what can I do with this? Well, so here I've rewritten the same equations in components now. So I can assume all the spins, the zero directions are along the z axis, because I'm assuming it. I'm starting from a collinear state. And I have the x deviations and the y deviations, and they can be written, so alpha is one of the tetrahedron, beta is the neighboring tetrahedron. Remember, these things live on a diamond lattice, and the coefficients eta, alpha, beta define a matrix. And there's no diagonal terms in this matrix. Yeah, there's no diagonal terms in this matrix. And as I say, these are just plus or minus 1, depending on the spin directions. I use a notation that eta alpha beta is equal to eta sub I, where I is the name of the label of the spin that lives on the line connecting tetrahedron diamond vertex alpha and diamond vertex beta. Okay, so, one thing I could do is I could square... what I want to do is I want to find the eigenvalues of that, of this eta matrix, basically. Or better, let me take this matrix, square this, you know, let me take delta, two time derivatives, and then I get that delta L alpha x times h omega squared is equal to this eta matrix squared acting on delta Lx, delta the x component. So I get an equation for the x component polarization, and I just have to diagonalize this eta squared matrix, and the eigenvalues of that will be omega squared. Okay, so in other words, what the bottom line is here. I want the sum of the omega of h bar omega, so that is simply, there's a factor of h bar here, but it's simply h bar times the trace of the square root of eta squared. The trace just adds up the eigenvalues. Now, okay, and I guess I commented here already that this thing is exactly gauge invariants. But let me go on to what I actually am going to do with it. So what I'm now going to do with it is I'm going to evaluate that square root by a Taylor expansion. The way I will do that is that this eta squared has got some part which is the identity matrix, because the eta, remember, the eta was something that I go, eta corresponds to taking a walk on the lattice. It's a matrix of things between latticeite alpha and beta. So when I take eta squared, the most important terms are those that come back to the origin, and that will give me a multiple of the identity matrix. If I subtract off that part, the rest of it is things which are walks from an even site to another even site, which is on an FCC lattice. And that's also nice because it's a Brevet lattice, and it's a hell of a lot easier dealing with Brevet lattices than it is to deal with non-Brevet lattices. So now the result then is that I say that I call W this matrix that I is what's left over after the identity, as just this non-diagonal terms of eta alpha beta eta beta gamma. Then I have this formula for the trace. I expand powers of W, and of course I'm not going to get anything. The only time I'm going to get something non-trivial from this is when the walk that's described by these links of W comes around in a loop. The first time it comes around, and if it goes this way and comes back, then I get the product of every eta twice, and eta squared is equal to 1. So if the terms that correspond to a loop to a path that just reverses itself will always be trivial terms. So the ones that go around in a loop are non-trivial, and you can also see that the first such term is W cubed, which is sixth order in the original matrix eta. And that will pick up, the first term that I will pick up is from the smallest loop, which is a hexagon. And that's simply the product of the eta's. Each eta, remember, lives on one edge of this hexagon. These are in the diamond lattice, and the spins are in the midpoint. So I'm taking the product of six of these, which is the same thing as six spins that lie in a hexagon. And so that is the way in which I got this effective Hamiltonian. Now, you may say, what aren't there other loops? Here is when I go to the next order. If I go to the next order, what I can say is, let me define a variable that I call tau sub u, which is the product of the six spins around a hexagon, and let me locate that on a site which is the midpoint of that hexagon. Now, what's real cute about this lattice is the midpoints of the hexagons live on another pyrochlore lattice. This is not a duality. I don't know what the name for it is, but anyway, it's interesting. And so now, furthermore, if I take the expansion to higher order, to the next order, the W4, or in other words, 8 steps of the original matrix, which was eta. If I take it to 8 steps, I get loops involving 8 spins. And this lattice has another kind of loop, which is a kind of puckered octahedron, which is a loop of 8 spins. So I have to worry about that as well, and that's where this term came from. But the amusing thing is that the loop of 8 spins can be written, the loop of 8 spins can be written as a hexagon and another hexagon which are sharing two of their vertices. So the two hexagons share two of their vertices. The remaining four spins of this hexagon and the four spins of the other hexagon constitute this octagon. And I can rewrite this formula, in other words, I can rewrite the term that came from the octagon as a product of tau mu and tau nu. So the end thing is I have an effective Hamiltonian now in terms of these Ising spins, which are products around a hexagon, that has a term which is linear and a term which is quadratic. And thank goodness these are not competing. Well, thank goodness, I mean, it would be interesting if they were, but in this case they're not competing. It is an effective field acting on these, which would want to align them all the same way, and the interaction, the pair interaction, is ferromagnetic between these objects, whatever you want to think of them. And so there's a well-defined answer is that they're all the products are minus 1. And you can actually find such a state. And,
I guess it's up there, but as you crank this expansion out, coefficients are getting rapidly smaller enough that...
Well, I mean, if you think about it, you know, if you go back and look at the original matrix, okay, that had eigenvalues that were 0, this thing you're taking the square root of. So there's no way that this is a truly convergent expansion. And I think that, so that's why I said it was uncontrolled.
But just if we take the terms you have here. Then...
I mean, what was sufficient to justify it to myself was that I calculated this thing for four trial configurations, one of which had got the tau's all positive, you know, in one case they're all +1, in one case they're all -1, and in two other cases they're half and half in different ways. And I satisfied myself that the energy of the two ways that they were half and half, that they were not so different from each other in energy. You don't know. I mean, Oleg Chernyshov has, and I guess you were on, Roderick, you were on this paper too, right, has extended this to another kind of weird lattice. And on that lattice, it doesn't work. On that lattice, what you would get from the naive, the lowest order loop, is not the right final answer. So I'm saying, I would interpret that, you know, I would say that, look, the structure of this is that you can show that there's this gate. Okay, so let me just comment that the form of this has a gauge-like symmetry that I can... change. Let's see. It was in the remarks I made when I had here, because it doesn't. It's not just within this approximation that I have the gauge-like symmetry, but it's an exact result. It's just that all I can say is I can let theta alpha be something which is +1 on every diamond side. And then I define an eta, a new set of the Ising spins, to be equal to the product of the two tetrahedrons that are that spin is involved with times the A to alpha beta. That will give me the new value of it. And these things, when I stick them into this matrix, will have the same exact eigenvalues, the same zero-point energy. Now, what I would have to worry about is that it's not necessarily a ground state of the original Pyro Club, because I got to have all the tetrahedra adding up to zero. So these two distinct kinds of conditions that have to be... because I have these two distinct conditions, it's not trivial making use of this gauge invariance idea. It's not a true gauge invariance, it's some kind of pseudo gauge invariance. What I would say is, because of this, it's necessarily true that all the terms in the effective Hamiltonian, I can imagine the effective Hamiltonian, I don't know what it really, but I know that every term in it has to be of this form. And so the only question I would say is that in the lattice that was studied by Ohlig and his collaborators, that it must be that the second term, you know, was bigger than the first term in that case. But I'm saying that I don't have the right answer to, you may have also, if you looked carefully, you know, when I did my expansion of the square root, I chose a particular amount of the identity matrix to expand it around. I could have shifted that. So there's an art in doing this, and I have not decided what is the best, you know, what's the best way to do this art. I think there is probably some optimal way that makes the next term be smallest, but I can't be sure whether the succeeding terms, you know, are still, you know, whether it's like an asymptotic expansion or something, or whether it's but I think that it's clearly the sort of thing that the closer you look at it, the less good it looks. But I'm saying that when your purpose is that you start off not having any idea what is the right state amongst this large number of states, this kind of thing is the first kind of guide that you have in the wilderness. That's what I'm viewing it as. It's a way of getting a guide into the wilderness of these states. I said it was like a fashion model. What? Okay. Okay, Leon. We have some of them, us find these states. Yeah, more of an erotic problem than others, I guess. Or is it exotic? Okay.
You're on the internet. Yeah.
I think that this is the what I wanted to show before the concluding remarks was just to impress you by showing the flashing pictures of these states. So I hope that these will be very. So I hope you'll find these as attractive as I do. These are pictures of the Pyro Club viewed down a z direction, a 100 axis, and it looks very much like a lattice, which I didn't even mention, the so-called planar Pyro Club or checkerboard lattice that Mersner and company have gotten a lot of mileage out of as a sort of toy version of the Pyro Club. And I also use this as a test bed for understanding this method when I was developing this approach. So the things which are shown as flashes are places where it actually doesn't connect from here to here, but it goes up to this is a slice of one layer, and it actually connects up to the next layer to form a spiral there. Anyway, these are states which are periodic in the z direction, and then they have a non-trivial large unit cell in the xy plane. And so this is one example which has got a unit cell which is 4 spins within the plane. This one has a unit cell of 8 spins. This has a unit cell of 32 spins, and of 64. There's an error in one of these labels that my student pointed out. But the loops of length 6 on this picture, I'm not sure you will see this fast enough, but if I take one of these squares, I go diagonally along it, I then go right, take a right turn, go down, go diagonally again and make another right turn. That's a loop. Can you see that this is a length 6 thing? This is actually a perfect hexagon viewed at a tilted angle. And so in this case, I have 4 green spins and 2 red spins, so the product is plus 1. So this is one of the simple states, and this is the worst possible state from the viewpoint of my effective Hamiltonian. Let's see, let's check out what this one was. This one also had, I take this loop, it's got 4 red and 3 green. I can find other loops where they are, 4 green and 2 red, so the product is, green is down, that's a minus 1. So the products are also plus 1 around every loop in that guy. So if I look, I think this is the one, let me check, is this the one where they're all minus 1? I think it is. Yes, this is the one where they're all minus 1. So this is the state which is selected, this thing with 32 spins. And the thing with 64 that I showed here, I think, was my idea of a state where half of them were plus and half of them were minus. And that shows these are outlining the hexagon and the octagon loops that I mentioned. So the concluding remarks, I have two sheets of these, that's all. On the pyrochlore, I mentioned that Oleg Chernyshev has used these ideas in several papers. For example, he's explored the thermal ensemble. Another thought to make this of interest to people in this room or not in this room, as the case may be, if you take the pyrochlore, Hermel and Fischer have studied the pyrochlore-Ising model with the ring exchange and found an interesting state coming from that. And I would like to point out that that's not so far from being realized by the kind of model I'm described. If you have this large S state, which is, you've got this large energy selecting it to be collinear, so then you might imagine that there's a relatively small energy which is breaking the difference between these different collinear states. It's actually of order S, so that's a dicey thing to assert, but the coefficients of these are typically small. And so for some intermediate value of the spin length, meanwhile you have tunneling terms, which I omitted here, which could take you out of the coplanar out of the collinear manifold, rotate the spins around in some way and back into the collinear manifold. And if those things they may cancel by symmetry for this situation. It will depend on whether S is integer or half integer, probably. But those will be exponentially small, but as I say, if S is small enough, that those tunneling terms could actually be bigger than the other terms. And in that case, you would have something which would be a realization, more or less, of the kind of model that they were writing about. And so that you could have something which, as I mentioned earlier in the talk, might develop some exotic state within a background of choosing an axis for the spins to be aligned with, which is a kind of so-called spin-nematic order. That's just a remark about, there's something funny, interesting about the relationship of finding this other lattice in the middle of the hexagons and whether you could create something analytic out of that. And finally, on the Kagame case, you can use similar approach, this effective Hamiltonian approach. I have done this for the classical Kagame-Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet, and I've sort of done it for the two-layer structure, which actually is the experimental system that people studied most, strontium, chromium, gallium oxide, which has got spin 3/2. It's like two Kagame lattices stacked on each other with some spins linking them. But it's also one of these lattices where the spins are on the midpoints of the edges of something bipartite. And so it falls within the same class as another kind of two-dimensional lattice. And I've studied what the selection would be within that. And of course, this is a footnote to the method that I use. Besides doing some kind of uncontrolled expansion analytically, one could also, if one believes in this sort of effective Hamiltonian approach, one could imagine doing calculations numerically on, say, small system sizes. If there's some, exact diagonalization or some other semi-analytic approach you can apply to that, to a family of states that you invent, you just think of a family of possible ground states and calculate the number for each of them, and then you try to fit that to some functional form as a guide to what might happen on even bigger lattices. So that's a purely empirical approach that's not that different from things that one might be doing in band structure theory or in what I also work on, the theory of quasicrystals. Anyway, thank you for your patience, and I await your questions.